Well, there is a dangerous and, quite frankly, deeply stupid trend making the rounds among teenagers. It's called the condom snorting challenge. I can't believe I just had to say those words out loud on the radio. Viral videos show teens inhaling condoms with no regard to the obvious risks. California-based pediatrician Daniel McCrimmons tells the Sacramento CBS affiliate inhaling condoms can pose serious consequences.
It's almost as if you're putting saran wrap up your nose. It could bypass the throat and then go into, lodge into the trachea. I think the common denominator then with all of these experimentations is that the kids just don't sense a feeling of personal happiness to sustain them. And they're looking for things to make them happy.
Well, snorting condoms isn't the only dumb thing people are doing. On social media, national news, and local shows, you've probably seen another internet craze: eating laundry detergent pods.
If you haven't heard of the Tide Pod Challenge, it's pretty simple. Teens video themselves eating laundry detergent, then post it online. Yeah, welcome to 2018.
Just like the condom snorting challenge, the Tide Pod Challenge is definitely weird, but more importantly, it's actually very dangerous. Dozens have been hospitalized across the country after doing this. People doing dumb stuff significantly predates the internet, of course, but we do see something new here, perhaps a different kind of dumb danger. I spoke with two guests about where the Tide Pod Challenge came from and what it says about the internet and its users. Jay Hathaway is senior writer for The Daily Dot, and Catherine O'Neill is an associate research scientist at the University of Georgia's College of Family and Consumer Sciences. So, Jay, as far as you have been able to trace the origins of this trend, where is it coming from?
Well, so Tide Pods were first launched back in 2012, and people were accidentally eating them way back then. That kind of turned into a joke. The Onion had a piece in 2015 called "So Help Me God, I'm Going to Eat One of Those Multicolored Detergent Pods." And they did another one mid-2017. So this has kind of been, you know, professional humorists have been joking about this for as long as Tide Pods have been around.
How do you reckon one accidentally eats Tide Pod? Does it sort of look like candy?
Oh, it absolutely looks like candy. And, you know, consumer advocates have pointed this out for a long time. Tide had to change the packaging like just months after Tide Pods came out so that you couldn't see through the box to the little candy-looking detergent pods inside, because kids were already mistaking them. Young kids were already mistaking them for candy.
Okay. So, so the question, well, one question here is, does Tide have any corporate responsibility for all of this? They have put out a PSA featuring who? Of course, Rob Gronkowski, Gronk of the New England Patriots. Let's listen.
No, 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 no. What the heck is going on, people? Use Tide Pods for washing, not eating. Do not eat.
Jay, how do you reckon Tide has responded to all of this?
So the CEO of Procter & Gamble, the Tide parent company, wrote a blog post. It basically blamed teens and parents for eating Tide Pods. He said, you know, we've tried everything. We've taken the Tide Pod Challenge videos down from YouTube. We did this PSA with Gronk. And even with the most stringent standards and protocols, labels and warnings, you know, they're still eating them. But, you know, the thing that he left out is they still look like candy.
Catherine O'Neill with the University of Georgia's College of Family and Consumer Sciences. As a scientist of human behavior, what interests you about this phenomenon?
Well, I think it's clearly just an overall interesting phenomenon, just because it is one that makes you almost scratch your head and wonder what's really going on here. But, you know, I think we couch this like thinking through it from a cognitive development standpoint. And we think about, we know that the frontal lobe of the brain isn't yet developed for adolescence. And we know that that's important because the frontal lobe is responsible for these executive functions that allow them to plan and have impulse control. And so this allows them to make good judgments, you know, think like what is right and wrong and what's harmful and helpful. And while that seems really intuitive, and it's something that adolescents really can do on many occasions, but occasionally they have those lapses where they don't use those skills, or they really can't because they don't have that rational part of their brain fully developed yet. And so instead they use the amygdala, which is like the emotional part of their brain. And so it's really all about like what's novel, that is what's new, and what's an increased risk. Like that's what's fun, that's what excites them. So So I think that's where it fits into, you know, like the Tide Pod Challenge. You know, if you think back to what you were just saying about, you know, what can Tide do? What do they need to do? I don't think for adolescents, it doesn't hinge on, oh, I just want to eat this because it looks like candy. I think it goes back to that, the lack of impulse control, and I'm doing it because of the larger Tide Pod Challenge, not necessarily because it looks like candy.
Yeah, yeah. So important to understand that kids don't just do dumb things out of lack of experience. It's in their hardwiring. Jay, do you think that the internet has uniquely enabled this problem? Is this something that could have happened prior to the internet age?
I mean, I suppose it could have, but the internet has definitely accelerated it. You know, it became a joke because of social media, and you know, the joke being, hey, these laundry detergent pods look like candy, but they're actually poisonous. And, you know, kids have like a pretty well-developed sense of irony, and they picked up on that pretty quickly. And, you know, because of that joke, Tide Pods became popular. And then it sort of spun into this big media thing about the Tide Pod Challenge. So, you know, I think without the internet, I don't think it would have happened nearly as fast.
Catherine, same question to you.
Yeah, well, I think that's the media component actually plays into the second part of adolescent development that's important here, which is like the social development. And we know that adolescence is a time where they really shift from thinking about, you know, parents and their family as the center of their interactions versus they're all about their peers and what do their peers think of them. And I think social media really gives them the platform to get immediate feedback in a lot of sense from their peers. You know, they post this Tide Pod Challenge, they get likes, they get shares, they get comments. And so I think that need for acceptance from peers is much easier to get through social media in the sense of these types of challenges. So, you know, could it exist without social media? Sure, I think it could. Like, would it have the ammunition? Would it have the amplification that it has? Likely not.
We're talking about the Tide Pod Challenge and other potentially dangerous internet memes and the risky behaviors that they can lead to. Poison control officials in Georgia say they've dealt with at least one case of a kid eating a Tide Pod and getting sick as a result. Lots and lots of other kids across the country have gotten very seriously sick eating these little laundry detergent pods that look like candy and about which people are daring them to eat. Talking to Catherine O'Neill, assistant research scientist at UGA's College of Family and Consumer Sciences. Also with us, Jay Hathaway, senior writer at The Daily Dot. We were talking to some folks on the street about what they make of this phenomenon. Here is Arthur from Decatur, Georgia.
I haven't personally eaten any Tide Pods, so I haven't faced the wrath of it, so it's kind of funny, yeah, but don't eat Tide Pods. That's not funny.
No, it's not funny. And here for me is the biggest question of the segment, Jay. Are we in the media actually causing the problem by talking about it?
To some extent, yeah. I mean, the Tide Pod thing started out as a joke. You know, kids didn't actually think eating Tide Pods was cool. They were just joking about how, you know, here's this product that's poisonous but looks like candy, and that's really funny to us. And, you know, as finally someone decided to go ahead and eat one. And whenever one or two kids do something stupid, it gets reported as a challenge. You know, there have been a lot of sort of fake internet challenges, like the hot water challenge wasn't a real thing, but there were dozens of news stories about it. So, you know, once the news says it's a challenge, then there's another group of kids that thinks that that's a real thing, and it kind of snowballs from there.
Right. And this is a relatively innocuous phenomenon like this. Obviously, it can really hurt people, but there is a slightly lighter side to all of this. This is a phenomenon that we see documented with very, very serious things as well. Things like suicide, when it gets reported by the media, can lead to other people choosing suicide. Mass shooting, identifying mass shooters. Some scientific research has indicated that can inspire other mass shooters to do terrible things. The question, Catherine, for us people like Jay and myself is, how can we responsibly report on these trends and let people know that this dangerous thing is happening without becoming part of the spiral of the problem?
Well, I mean, So for me, I think, yes, there is some research that exposure or, like, you know, hearing about mass shootings can prompt a mass shooting. I think you don't see that happening in someone who doesn't already have some degree of inclination towards, you know, being a mass shooter or being someone who does impulsive things. So for me, I think context is important. We always have to consider not just that one single event, like, you know, media is going to cause something. There's a lot of contextual factors that go into any behavior that occurs. And so I think in general, the media does a relatively well job. I'm sure some sources better than others of reporting both the positives and the negatives and being upfront about what is occurring and why it's occurring and not over-sensationalizing things. And so for me, I think as long as that continues, it's not so much what can the media do above and beyond that. It's what can parents and adults and others around do to, you know, further the education. So specifically about the Tide Pod Challenge, you know, talking to their youth and trying to encourage not just don't eat Tide Pods, but just in general, like the trying to steer them away towards these impulsive behaviors.
Indeed. And as a closing thought here, what advice would you give to parents, Catherine? I think some of them are probably worried that if they tell their children not to eat a Tide Pod, that that might have the opposite effect.
So I've been asking myself this question, what could I do for my own kids? And I think one thing that I can do that I would encourage parents to do is to try and encourage adolescents to see the fragile nature of life and that things that can be dangerous really do have the long-term consequences. I know adolescents aren't wired to see things that way, and encourage them to make good choices. Always telling them, I tell my five-year-old, just make good choices, you know, be kind, be loving, and think about, you know, being helpful both to your own self and to others around you.
That's Catherine O'Neill. She's an associate research scientist at the University of Georgia's College of Family and Consumer Sciences. We're also joined there by Daily Dot senior writer Jay Hathaway. My two cents, if you care, well, whether it's Tide Pod Challenge or the Condom Snort Challenge or any other brainless fad, just don't do it. These people who want you to do this, they're not your friends. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Members of an American neo-Nazi party called the National Socialist Movement plan a rally in Newnan, Georgia, later this month. Some people in Newnan worry this rally could get violent. There is a Change.org petition to urge the city not to allow it. What do you think should be done about extremism? Can an extremist change? We spoke with Shannon Martinez of Athens. She was a skinhead for a number of years, but managed to leave that life behind her. She spoke with GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley.
Just a note to our listeners, parts of this conversation may not be suitable for young ears. Now, Shannon, you actually joined a skinhead group when you were a teenager, right? Quite young.
Yes, when I was in between 15 and 16 years old.
So let's walk through what happened then and how you ended up joining that group. Because as I understand it, you yourself considered yourself to be liberal at that point.
When we would sit around the dinner table, my family tended towards much more conservative politics and arguments, whereas I took the much more liberal view. I loved the Beatles as a middle schooler and the culture of the 60s.
You described your family, I'm sorry to interrupt,
sure.
You described your family as having acceptable middle-class racism. What does that mean?
I don't mean that from a personal point of view at this point in my life, but the racism that is so much a part of what we deem as acceptable, where we stay silent now, where it's, you know, little jokes that involve race or little derogatory remarks if somebody cuts you off in traffic, or it's okay to start talking about property values diminishing as members of different races move into an all-white neighborhood, things like that, that they found overt racism to be abhorrent and said so. But on the other hand, there was this other conversation that was always going on.
So you went from not really buying into that acceptable racism, which again is a euphemism, to
I was in a breakdance group as a little girl a bunch of multicultural people.
Right. So how did you then end up being in a hate group?
Just before my 15th birthday, I went to a party with some friends. During that time, I was being drawn towards counterculture movements, skateboarders, and then from there, like punk rock. I never quite felt like I fit in my family. I felt like there was a lot of perfectionism that was part of my family that I never really could quite measure up. Real or perceived, that was how I felt in my family. And so I didn't have a deep, strong sense of belonging. And then we moved from where I had grown up outside of Philadelphia to rural Michigan, just over the border of Ohio. And I lost all sense of personal identity that I had been building since I was young, coupled with the fact that I didn't feel a strong connection and identity as part of my family. And so I started being drawn to like skateboard culture and then punk rock culture, like looking for identity outside of myself. I went to a party when I was 14, just shy of my 15th birthday. And at that party, I was raped by two men. And that was how I lost my virginity. It would take me another 10 years to even be able to frame what happened to me that way. I understand now how the brain deals with trauma and why that would be so. But instead of going to my parents, I knew on some level that if I told them that had happened, that I would be in trouble because I had lied about where I had gone and I had been drinking. And I know that the core of who I was couldn't accept that anyone placing blame on me for this outrage, for this trauma that had happened to me, that it wasn't my fault. And that began a cycle of deep self-loathing, and because I had all of this unprocessed trauma. And so I just began to just hate myself and my body and see myself as worthless and not having any value. And that would be a slow process, really, as that kind of took over like a sickness in my being. And then so about 6 months on down the road, I broke up with the first like real boyfriend that I had. And then, you know, and then it was like the anger consumed me. And I was already involved in the punk rock movement. And there were skinheads on the periphery of that. And they were the angriest people in this already sort of angry subculture. And so I was able to identify with their anger and was like, wow, those are my people. Those are the people I want, like, I want to be around.
And it sounds like
and
you're
all
saying,
you had to do was be angry.
Right. And it sounds like what you're saying is that to fit in and become, as you say, angry, part of learning to hate other people was learned. That was part of fitting into that group. Is that accurate?
Yes, I believe that is accurate. And for me, it wasn't a big step because I hated everybody. And so in a strange way, it was almost a relief to make my anger and the rage that I felt smaller and more focused, that instead of just raging with everything and just all the time, it was like, well, all I have to do is say, join in and say, I hate black people. I hate Jews. I hate all non-white people. And so it would be a process of that, but that I understood that was the price of admission. And it was almost a relief because it took this big amorphous, ineffable rage that I felt and at least gave it a name.
So I want to play you this comment. We talked about hate groups earlier this week, and this is a psychology professor from the University of Maryland named Ariai Kuglansky, and he's talking about why it's not a good idea to mock a skinhead or someone who is a white supremacist.
If you mock their beliefs, they're going to push back. There's going to be a blow-up. There's going to be a boomerang effect. So you must be careful not to offend their beliefs. You have to reach out to them, listen to their concerns, and provide the alternative ways of thinking.
What do you make of that mocking is not the right approach?
I have seven kids, so I am able to toe the line of saying, hey, the behavior is unacceptable. Like, what you are doing and putting forth is not acceptable on any level. But let's talk about what you believe. Let me hear you and not talk past you and not belittle you, because you clearly have a reason that you believe so strongly about this that you're willing to, you know, join a rally in Charlottesville or wherever the rally might be or engage online. Like, you clearly hold this belief dear to you. So instead of being like, wow, you're just, you know, you're just a worthless piece of trash, very likely they already believe that. And saying that causes an embattlement. If you refuse to truly hear someone and where they're coming from, that the tendency is to become defensive almost immediately. And so it will be completely ineffective if you are truly trying to dialogue with someone, even with an abhorrent point of view, if you just mock and belittle them, and you will entrench them further. If shame is at the root and disconnection from others and a sense of objectifying other human beings is at the root, then objectifying the person with whom you're trying to dialogue just exacerbates the problem, and there's just a deepening cycle of disconnect from others.
Well, on that note, let's bring Sammy Rangel into the conversation. He's the executive director of Life After Hate, which is a nonprofit group that helps people move away from violent extremism. And Sammy joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Sammy.
Good morning.
So I want to play another comment from Ariai Kruglansky of the University of Maryland, a psychology professor, talking about the fact that people, just like Shannon, but people who are extremists are actually redeemable.
You know, radicalization is not a terminal disease. In the same way as a person gets radicalized, he or she can get de-radicalized, and they can also get re-radicalized. You know, the human psyche is a very fluid, malleable kind of entity.
So what do you make of this, Sammy? Because we're living in a time when people say there are some people you just can't talk to. What's your response to that?
Well, I would say you're talking to one right now, and, you know, our Formers Network within Life After Hate in other areas of work that I do is full of people who were deemed, diagnosed as incorrigible, antisocial, sociopathic, and many of the members of this group were the leaders and the faces of these hate groups, these extremely violent groups. And yet today, if you were to sit down with any one of us, if you didn't know our background, you would never guess. And if you did know our background, you might be amazed at the transition and the transformation that everyone has gone through and is going through in order to maintain that.
Do you agree with both Shannon that mocking is or shaming is not productive?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, we're noticing a trend that has reemerged where this collective shame may be contributing to some of the radical feelings and ideas that people are developing currently right now in the alt-right.
This is from The Washington Post and NBC that says the number of people who think neo-Nazi views are acceptable has now doubled since Charlottesville. Shannon, why do you think that is?
I think a lot of that has to do with packaging and marketing. When these views, when confronted, the default position, as it was for me over 20 years ago, as it is today, is that, well, we're not really racist. We want to have everyone to have their own little areas where they live and where, you know, like where we don't think we're better than people of other races. We just want to have our own little space where we get to just do white people things, and we don't, and everyone can do their own ethnic things in their own little area, and it's not really about racism. And at the same time, they also say, well, you know, there's Black Pride and Black Lives Matter. Don't our lives matter too? Don't we count for something? And people resonate with that because they don't really understand what the arguments truly are. Because what the argument really is we're white and we're better and we don't want to be polluted, so to speak, by the ongoings of people that don't look like us.
So, Sammy, let me play you this comment. These comments from former Atlanta mayor and UN ambassador Andrew Young have become controversial. Here he is speaking on NBC's Meet the Press.
The reason I feel uncomfortable condemning the Klan types is they're almost the poorest of the poor. They're the forgotten Americans. They have been used and abused and neglected. Instead of giving them affordable health care, they give them black lung jobs, and they're happy. And that just doesn't make sense in today's world.
What do you make sense of that argument, Sammy?
I guess just being straightforward, I don't make sense of that. But what I do think is happening in alignment with what Shannon is saying is that a lot of the people that are feeling marginalized right now, who are newer to the so-called movement, do feel like there are some social injustices that have come out of like civil rights movement type initiatives that have tried to balance out the scale because of overt systemic racism and our historical racism in our country. And so it's a twist of the truth in a sense where we're saying that, well, because of like issues like affirmative action, whites are being denied jobs. Well, the problem with that is that we have to acknowledge history. We have to acknowledge that there was a reason for trying to balance out the system. But what they're actually saying is playing on feelings of people who feel a little bit, who have some sort of grievance with the way politics are going, with the way their lives are going, the way things seem. And then they find a way to send this message that, hey, we're with you, we're on your side, but you also have to adopt some of these other beliefs. Quite often, many of the people that I'm talking to who are still on that other side, their grievances are almost cookie cutter. You can almost predict what their grievances are going to be. And it's almost like they think they're thinking for themselves, but their comments and their viewpoints are kind of that rhetoric, are kind of like scripted for them, and then that's what they're pursuing. And so these groups feel like they're victims, and they also feel, when I was talking about collective shame, they also feel very removed from the days of slavery, very removed from the days of World War II eras. And so they're wondering why they're still carrying the burden of their ancestors and almost feel as if it's unfair of anyone to put that on them. And it's, I'm not debating whether it is or not, or whether or not there's any validity to that. But if we're going to try to understand how to dismantle some of this hate, we have to understand where their grievances are coming from as we move forward.
So we have a tweet from Lindsay who says, there's a massive difference between listening and tolerating. I think too often people confuse the two, which leads to more radicalism. And let me play one more comment. This is from an African-American blues musician named Daryl Davis, and he's sort of made it his job to go around convincing KKK members to quit.
The fact that a Klansman and a black person could sit down at the same table, enjoy the same music, that was a seed planted. So what do you do when you plant a seed? You nourish it. And I decided to go around the country and sit down with Klan leaders and Klan members to find out, how can you hate me when you don't even know me?
Shannon, we only have a minute left, but what is the best advice, one thing somebody could do if they end up talking to someone who hates?
I think to help them feel truly heard, validate their viewpoint, and make it absolutely unequivocally clear that you do not agree, and that in America that level of hate and objectification of other human beings is unacceptable.
But hear them out.
Yes, hear them out.
That was former skinhead Shannon Martinez. She lives in Athens, Georgia. We also heard there from Sammy Rangel, the executive director of the nonprofit group Life After Hate. They spoke to GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley. Well, this is National Autism Awareness Month. About 1 in 68 children has been identified as having an autism spectrum disorder. Research from the A.J. Drexel Autism Institute shows that young adults with autism have higher rates of complete social isolation than people with other disabilities. One place to prevent that isolation is on the baseball field. A Georgia athletic program is designed to help teens and adults with autism and special needs. The Alternative Baseball Organization is for those who want to showcase their talents on the baseball diamond. My colleague Leah Fleming sat down with the group's founder, Taylor Duncan.
All right. So, Taylor, you were diagnosed with autism at the age of 4, and you grew up dealing with several stereotypes about people who had the special needs like you have.
Right.
So what are some of the stereotypes that you experienced as a kid growing up?
When I was much younger, I had sensory issues, speech issues, anxiety issues, amongst many other issues associated with being on the autism spectrum. But to me, they're not really what I would call stereotypes. They would be more like barriers, hurdles, disadvantages that can be overcome with a time and a structure and set up for success. And my mother, thanks to the help from my mother, my family, my teachers and mentors and coaches who believed in me, and most certainly the Lord up above who's brought me all this way, I've been able to get to where I am today to be able to run this organization.
Did you want to play baseball as a kid?
Absolutely.
And did you?
I did 1 year, and that was pretty good. And then the next year, a new coach took over and deemed me too much of an injury risk due to having autism. So that left me no place to continue developing my skill or developing my passion when I had finally had been deemed ready to play the year before.
So he deemed you too much of an injury risk.
Correct. Yes, ma'am.
He thought that you could get hurt because of autism.
He just really wanted to win, and, you know, he had a roster that was obviously picked through. But what I'm trying to say without sounding negative is he had his own agenda. Those who didn't quite fit the bill, you know, got the shaft.
So I would imagine that this is what inspired you to go on and create.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because I read one of Temple Grandin's books one time when I rented it from the library. When you have a deficiency in the brain, there's never a hole in it. There's always something to fill it up, and countless number of studies in science have proven that. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, you know, a lot of folks on the spectrum really can think with their heads, and baseball is largely a mental sport.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you began to pull this organization together.
Yes, ma'am. And we started in January of 2016, and we recruited players through the school system, Craigslist, other classified websites until we finally had enough to start getting up and running. And once we got it up and going, we had our first game, I think, in April, where Ken Vanderpool of Atlanta International Umpires, some of them had been in the minor leagues, and Ken had actually officiated in the Olympics in the Atlanta 1996 games. I think he was the head of the umpires. They help us with their umpires, so it gives us a really official look and gives them as close to a professional experience as we possibly can. We use Major League Baseball rules all the way down to a T with the addition of some modified rules. We only use wood bats, but we use an adaptive ball that's a little bit larger but much softer than a regulation size baseball.
Okay. So do you you throw overhanded?
It depends on the hitter, but many of them are pitched to overhand from 45 to 72 miles per hour. We got a new kid who we touched on the radar gun. He touched 70 miles per hour.
Wow. Yeah. So that's a little bit of skill right there.
We know that there's a lot of talent out there, and those that are just starting out, it's a great place for them to form social relationships as well. And be able to learn the social skills that they need through this opportunity to learn through experiences with teamwork, to be able to take these skills, whether it be in or outside the sport, or when they get employed as they get older. They're all going to be, social skills are going to be needed when they are employed when they get older so that they can keep a job.
So what is the future? What does that hold for your baseball organization? Would you like to one day play in the new SunTrust Park?
That would be absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. That would be an totally awesome opportunity. I was there in June, but I would really like to play a game there in front of a big crowd.
Okay.
That would be so much fun.
Yeah.
And a big experience, too.
Yes.
Never forget it.
Yeah. Do you have other plans for your organization moving forward?
Absolutely. We're working on an expansion program, and we've had neighborhoods and communities in 25-plus different states and countries ask us for our help in getting their own programs up and running. We're in the process of starting our new network. We had just gotten our 501c3 status in September. So we're working on that, and hopefully we'll have something launched in 2018 to where we can start launching all these programs and start expanding first through the Southeast, and then we're going to go through the rest of the country and then eventually the entire world.
That's Taylor Duncan, founder of the Alternative Baseball Organization. He spoke with my colleague Leah Fleming. The group's next game is April 15th. Details at gpbnews.org. Now, Asperger's syndrome is a neurobiological disorder on the higher functioning end of the autism spectrum. Neurological disorders, as a rule, are not funny, but that doesn't mean the people who suffer from them are not funny. Take members of the comedy troupe Asperger's Are Us. They all actually do have Asperger's syndrome, and they are pretty funny.
Oh, really great. Glad to be here at this comedy show tonight.
Yeah, it's great to support people with disabilities by just throwing your money at them.
Yeah, I mean, I never actually befriended them in real life, but it feels great.
No.
It feels great to support them, though.
Yeah, you know, I heard it's pretty funny, too.
At least it'll alleviate our prejudice and help their guilt complex.
Yep, see, they've got Asperger's and they are funny. But the members of Asperger's RS do not let their condition define their comedy. I talked a while back with two of the group's members. With me is Jack Hanke. Hi, Jack.
Hi.
And also with you there is Ethan Finlan with us. Hi, Ethan.
Hi there.
So what's your origin myth? How did this group come together?
Well, our origin myth is that we were built from the dust that accumulated on a turtle that, yes, that the Earth rested on, but that's definitely not true. It's just a myth.
The Earth rests on multiple turtles. So.
Oh, yeah. It's turtles all the way down.
Yeah. we met in 2005 at a camp that was set up for folks on the spectrum, particularly those with Asperger's syndrome. Noah, who's another member, he was our counselor at the time, and the four of us formed a bond that went deeper than the usual camper counselor, or as the correct terminology would be, inmate warden. We all sort of discovered that we had the same kind of sense of humor, and people found us pretty funny. So 5 years later, really, we decided to set up a comedy group.
Let me ask you this, guys. My sense is that people who are on the autism spectrum, humor is like one of the things that they tend to have particular trouble with. It rests so much on perception of often very subtle social stuff that folks on the spectrum almost by definition have trouble with. Is that am I just wrong in my sense of that, or is that just an issue that you guys deal with in doing your work?
Well, that's largely a misconception, although there is truth to it. And I want to give a sort of cautionary note and say there are certainly people on the spectrum, people with Asperger's, who don't find what we do funny. Conversely, though, there are people who are not, who think it's some of the funniest stuff they've ever seen. Speaking directly to your question, a lot of times, for instance, Aspies, as is a, it's a not a pejorative term, generally.
That actually sounds like an award of some kind.
Yeah, it does. Good point.
Yeah, yeah. People who get Asperger's diagnosed are awarded the Aspie Award, yeah. Where we get to call each other that.
Yep. So sometimes people with Asperger's will have trouble picking up on jokes, in some cases sarcasm. That wasn't really an issue for me ever, but our sense of humor is a bit different than, I suppose you would say, the average person. A lot of literal humor, a lot of wordplay. We tend to find that a lot more humorous than, say, observational stuff. At least in our case, we'll have more of a taste for the absurd stuff. So if something goofy happens on a sitcom where the intent is like, oh, well, it's making fun of this guy, which we think is pretty mean, actually.
Yeah, kind of stupid and easy, too.
And stupid and easy. But if something sort of absurd happens as a result, like, we find humor in the absurdity of it. And again, that doesn't speak for everyone on the spectrum, but to say that Aspie's struggle with humor is largely a misconception, although it's based on truth, but it's exaggerated largely.
I'd also add that, I mean, I don't call it a disorder personally. It has a lot of material advantages. I mean, for example, we're much We're more literal, which means that we can see patterns. I think we see patterns more easily. So yeah. Wordplay comes more natural to naturally to us. Puns are much quicker for us than they are for other people. So there's a lot of things here that we can do we probably wouldn't be able to do if we weren't Aspies.
Let's listen to another clip from your show. Here is the troop member that you were talking about before, Noah Britton, playing the part of an actor being interviewed by two casting directors that are played by you, Jack, and you, Ethan. The first voice that we hear is going to be Ethan's. Let's listen.
I see here that you were in Home Alone.
I played Kevin's special tutor.
Oh, and it says you were in Citizen Kane?
I was the newspaper.
And you were in Jurassic Park?
I was all of the dinosaurs.
Talk to us about where that sketch comes from.
Oh, wow. That's a really old one.
Wow.
We haven't done that one in like 5 years. So that is a character that Noah came up with, his motif is acting sort of creepy and talking very slowly like this.
Yeah, it's heavily in body language too.
Yeah, that one. It's kind of hard to get listening to. But that was one from our earlier career, and you can certainly see the absurdity there. Absurdity, as I mentioned, big part of what we do as a group, certainly, where he's saying, "I'm all the dinosaurs."
Yeah, I mean, it's absurd in the sense that the character, basically, you can't tell that from the snippet, but he's somebody who is, everything he says is, he's not actually creepy, or he's not actually doing anything wrong or anything that's actually
unseemly.
Dangerous. But I mean, he comes across in his body language and his voice as very creepy. So that's sort of a unexpected disconnect. I mean, comedy is the art of the unexected. So that's the premise of the joke. Oh, they don't think it's very well executed there. We've learned from that.
do you guys ever? I mean, you're the name of your troupe, Asperger's R Us, is a joke about Asperger's. But does the content of your show ever tread into jokes about Asperger's?
No, that's not actually a joke about Asperger's.
Oh, really?
Again, we can see why someone would think that. We've often said that, if we were to go back, we would have picked a different name because people kind of assume, like, because of the poor grammar, it's some sort of riff on Asperger's. But we really did it just to identify who we are. Like, yeah, we're all people with Asperger's. As to your other question, we don't make jokes about Asperger's. Certainly not in the sense where it's like, oh, well, I do this thing differently, or I struggle with executive functioning, and that's funny. We think that's obnoxious and stupid. What we do incorporate is stuff that's satirical towards that mentality. So, for instance, that first clip you played.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the butt of that joke is people like me who might not understand Asperger's and get uncomfortable around dealing with it.
Well, not so much that as people who hear about our show and they're like, oh, wow, that's such a brave thing to do. I'm going to out of pity,
Yeah, yeah, very patronizing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we're not interested in pity. We're interested in money.
Yeah. If someone with that mindset comes and they're like, wow, that's pretty funny, or even if they don't think we're funny and they're like, oh, that's kind of cool. I'm happy to see them change their mind, but I mean, we're not in this to raise awareness. We're in this because we're all funny and the name comes from us all happening to have Asperger's, and we do believe that it has an influence on our style of humor.
Jack Haneke and Ethan Finlan are members of the comedy troupe Asperger's R Us. The group's four members all have Asperger's syndrome, which is under the autism diagnosis umbrella. April is National Autism Awareness Month. That's why we're talking about this. And that's our show for today.